The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Tonight's speaker is Leslie Grant. And Leslie, can you introduce yourself? I may mangle this. I've seen your bio, but whether or not I'm under the impression that you're a Waldorf teacher. Is that true?
I run a program that is in Marin County that's Dharma and Waldorf inspired for parents and children. We have a website now, www.mindfulness-education.org. And basically, we're kind of a unique program for parents and children in that we have a place for parents to practice meditation and a place for the children to come together. We have our main program 5 days a week is for young children, kind of 3 to up to kindergarten age. And parents practice on site on a rotating basis, as parents would participate in a children's co-op. But they have like a half-day retreat that's at the same time that the children are practicing. And the children also spend some time in the shrine room doing yoga and doing some forms of meditation that they can do and having some Dharma talks. So it's actually a parent-child center. And then the parents have interviews, actually, during their half-day retreat if they want that. And they have also mindfulness meditation class. And then we do some events that are for the parents and children. So I call it Waldorf and Dharma Inspired. And I have taught adults. I've taught graduate students, and I've taught children. And I was a Buddhist nun. And when I came back to lay practice, because my goddaughter needed a parent, basically, I came back from being in robes and to get my visa renewed to go back to Asia to continue being a nun. And found out that a child that I'd committed to be her godmother, needed me. And so I was in robes and I was a parent, which was really kind of how I got into putting the two things together, partly. I had also been a teacher for many years before. So it's a small program in a sense, but actually because the whole families are involved, parents, siblings, children, then we have some groups for older children too, 7 to 11-year-old girls group we just started, and then there's a man that I'm going to be co-teaching a boys group with. But basically there are about 100 people involved one way or another in our program. It's a lovely thing, and the other talks that I've done here were specifically about that, for teachers. We also are starting a program for teachers who are children's teachers, who are interested in working with their own practice within the context of the daily life experience of teaching, and who are also interested in the possibility of at some point becoming ready to bring that into classrooms in different ways. We don't have a full training for that really yet. It's more of a forum to discuss that we have between teachers. And then we're also starting to have some people who have done a lot of Dharma practice and are interested in the possibility of working with children. So some people are coming in through that door, and some people are coming in through being a credentialed teacher and coming in through that door and being interested in this. So, that's a lot of my background. Thank you. So tonight, anyway, first of all, I'm really happy to be here. And how I got to the Sati Center, actually, and this particular context, is that Gil Fronsdale, who's been who's a teacher for the Buddhist chaplaincy training, I've been in that training. I've been in the Buddhist chaplaincy training, and so he invited me to come and speak to you on this Thursday night. And I've just been really happy with that training, first of all, and I'd like to, if there's anybody thinking about it out there, to commend it to you. It's been a wonderful experience to go through that and be with a lot of other people who are practicing, who are wanting to bring their practice off the cushion. Not that we don't sometimes go back to the cushion, of course, every day a bit, but out into the world in some way. So there are people in that training who are working with in prisons and people who are working in hospitals and people who are working with vets that are recovering from the situation of having been in war. And so it's a really beautiful situation to look at one's practice in relationship to service. And whether or not some of the people in that training actually are interested in a path of becoming a professional chaplain, but a lot of us aren't. For a lot of us, it's just part of our practice. And for me, it's been a support for developing the program that I'm developing with parents and teachers. So I wanted to say that. I'm very glad to be here. And that actually relates to the topic. I want to talk tonight a little bit about practice and motivation in practice and how that motivation develops and might bring us out into various things in the world. Part of that, I want to touch on what's called bodhicitta aspiration, the aspiration to awaken to benefit beings. But I want to talk about it from the perspective of that kind of spark that kindles us to, from our practice, want to serve others, and also how doing that really serves our practice. And that's part of what I work with parents and with teachers, that sense that we are embracing our whole lives as part of our path and part of our practice, that there's our sitting practice, mindfulness practice, and then there's this rich opportunity we have in every moment of our experience to bring that mindfulness into our lives and to be inspired by what we encounter in our lives in a way that embraces it as no different than a thought or a feeling arising in practice. So I want to talk about that a little bit. And I want to tell you a story. So Guy Armstrong, who probably quite a few of you knew, I guess he was here recently with Gil teaching. He's been one of my teachers, and he's been a mentor for my program for a long time. I've actually been practicing for 25, 26 years. Part of my practice has been in this tradition, a lot of it, with Guy and with Jack, mostly Western teachers, although Ajahn Jamnin has also been a teacher for me. And part of my practice was in the Tibetan tradition. And Sogmi Rinpoche, who has taught some at Spirit Rock, has been one of my teachers. Actually, Guy introduced me. This is from something Guy wrote on the Paramis, a historical background. And this is a story about Shakyamuni Buddha before he was Shakyamuni Buddha, before he was a Buddha. And it comes from a piece that Guy wrote, I thought it would be nice to share it. It says, 4 incalculable and 100,000 eons before our present age, which is to say a very, very, very long time ago, an ascetic named Sumidra was practicing the path to arhatship when he received word that a fully awakened one, a Buddha named Dipankara, was teaching in a town nearby. He traveled there and found Dipankara Buddha being venerated in a long procession, attended by most of the townspeople. Sumedha was immediately touched with deep reverence upon seeing the noble bearing and vast tranquility of the Buddha. He realized that to become an arhat would be of great benefit to humankind, but that the benefit to the world of a Buddha was immensely greater. At that very moment, in the presence of Dipankara Buddha, he made a vow to become a Buddha in a future life. This marked his entry into the path of the Bodhisattva, a being bound for Buddhahood. Just then, Sumedha noticed that the Buddha was about to walk through a patch of wet mud. Spontaneously, out of great devotion, he threw his body down in the mud and invited the Buddha and his Sangha to walk over him rather than dirty their feet. As the great teacher passed, Dipankara Buddha read Sumedha's mind and understood his aspiration and predicted that that ascetic, Sumedha, would fulfill his vow to become a Buddha at a time 4 incalculables and 100,000 eons in the future. It was also revealed that Sumedha, that had he not made that aspiration to become a Buddha, he would have realized full enlightenment that day by listening to a discourse from Dipankara Buddha. This would have ended Sumedha's own suffering and also his chain of rebirths. But the Bodhisattva chose instead to devote inconceivable lifetimes of practice to attain the ultimate goal, Buddhahood. Having resolved on this goal, Sumedha then retired to his cave to reflect, "How can I make this vast journey?" he wondered. "What aspects of mind and heart do I need to develop in order to become a Buddha?" As he reflected, he saw that there were 10 wholesome qualities that he would need and that to bring this strength and this aspiration to maturity, he would need these qualities. The factors that came to his mind one by one were generosity, virtue, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, determination, loving kindness, and equanimity. He called this set the paramis, which has usually been translated as perfections. He then began the journey of innumerable lifetimes to develop the perfections of heart and mind that finally unfolded in his full enlightenment as Gautama Buddha under the Bodhi tree. So, these beautiful qualities of heart and mind that inspired him. As I hear these teachings and I connect with in myself my own process, it was a long time before my practice really had anything to do with my aspiration to benefit others. In my own path, for a lot of years of practice, I struggled a lot with a lot of anger. We all kind of in Buddhist psychology, there's a tendency of the mind usually to either grasping or aversion or delusion. We've all got all of them. We get them all in a package. But often we kind of lean more to one or another. Mine in the beginning when I started like 25 years ago was anger. I had a lot of anger. So much so that I'd go away on retreat. And I lived in a group household then. And I would go on these loving kindness retreats. And my housemates would remark that I'd come back angrier than before. And they just couldn't understand why I went away to do this thing. And then I'd come back so angry. And I said, "I don't know, I just have to do it." And how I understand that to be, and so loving kindness, I think you're practicing mindfulness in group, but probably most of you have been exposed to metta or loving kindness practice as well. How I understand that is that we kind of aim our heart in a direction. And we aim our heart in loving kindness. We do these phrases. And it's not like pushing the button on the Coke machine. The Coke comes out. You know, the machinery is tangled up in there somehow often. And so there's this kind of purification where everything else kind of comes up first or can. And that was really my case. And it took a lot of years of kind of flushing my heart up with this practice and watching these different, you know, aspects of my mind come up that were really strong that I hadn't in a way really realized the strength of before. And one of the first insights I had in my own practice was that, wow, there's aversion, there's anger, there's grasping, and there's delusion in my mind. And not only that, but people have been experiencing this from the time of the Buddha and before. So there was this kind of way that insight helped me feel more connected with humanity as a whole and with the sense of the that somehow my little mind that I thought was my own little mind wasn't really just my own little mind. You know, we grow up in this culture and we have kind of a brain and we have this body and the brain is sort of our mind, we think, usually in this culture. And, you know, it's kind of ours. and what happens in it is kind of ours. And we may or may not be that aware of what the details of what's going on, but we think it's ours. But that was sort of the first insight for me into the fact that this wasn't just my mind. There was a process that had been going on for millennia, and people had been having these kind of experiences of mind. So for a lot of years, my practice was just like, how do I embrace that? How do I kind of deal with that without it taking over too much and being too hard on other people? So when I first heard these teachings about, you know, aspiring to benefit others, I actually heard His Holiness the Dalai Lama speak about this years before I was involved with Tibetan Buddhism. And he said, if you're past 40, and at that point I wasn't, I was younger, he said, it's time to stop thinking about what the world could do for you and think about what you can do for the world. Well, I thought I had quite a long time to actually figure that out. I wasn't close to 40 then. And really, my kind of motivation was pretty much in the beginning to deal with my own suffering. I heard Sylvia Boorstein at one point give a talk at Spirit Rock, and there were about 300 people there at the talk. And she asked a really interesting question. She said, how many of you, of this 300 people, started your practice with the motivation of becoming more compassionate? And really honestly, how many of you did? Like a smattering of a few people raised their hand. Not very many. And then she said, then of those of you who practiced for a number of years, I think she said 5 years or more, how many of you, so she asked how many people that was, and it was a lot of that particular group, how many of you actually find that you become more compassionate through practice? And most of the group raised their hand. This is very interesting to see that it was kind of an emergent quality, really, out of practice. And that's very much what I found in my own experience, is that at a certain point, my anger started to settle down, and the loving kindness actually started generating loving kindness, quite finally, after many years. And then that the loving kindness could kind of embrace the anger and other emotions. So first it was an experience that it could do that with myself. So there was this loving kindness, and then when my anger arose, instead of it just kind of like lashing out at somebody immediately or lashing out inwardly at myself, there was this kind of loving space around it. Where it was like, oh, wow, there's anger, but there's like something else here that's holding that anger. That's kind of a sweetness. And then eventually that began to extend into, you know, when other people would be really angry, it became sort of like a knee-jerk reaction after enough mats of practice that would kind of hold that. So I began to see the power that really practicing this would directly touch what was difficult for me, one of the most difficult ones, which was anger. So as I began to look myself at kind of my tendencies of mind and see that something, you know, could change in my mind, that it wasn't just like I was stuck with it forever, that there's a pattern. One of the stories Jack tells, and probably maybe some of you have heard this, but he put, maybe all of you, who knows, but if you put an acorn in the ground, you get this, you know, there's an acorn sprout, and then there's an oak tree, and then the oak tree drops acorns, and then the acorns fall, and then an acorn seed plants, and you get this sprout, and you get a tree, and you drop acorn. There's a pattern going on. So in that sense, I had a pattern, I had an anger pattern, and there's a pattern, but that I wasn't just stuck with like living in that pattern or only being mindful. In the beginning, I just wanted to be mindful enough of it that it didn't just run my life. That was like enough for me in the beginning. And then I began to see that actually things started to change. Maybe, you know, we can see that over some time. So, as we sit and that first storm of these patterns showing up starts to kind of have enough spaces in it that we start to feel these other qualities, there, I started to see that actually things that were said in teachings about wanting to benefit beings and having that kind of feeling arise spontaneously actually, you know, started to happen in practice. And I already, for a lot of my life, I'd done work in medical settings, and I'd, you know, taught and things like that. But this sense that there was this, you could actually direct the mind toward this possibility of aspiring to awaken, that there was a motivation to awaken to benefit beings. Now, the first form of that was kind of to awake, wanting to awaken, just not to be hurting people around me too much, which is really part of that aspiration, right? We start to see, actually, oh, wow, you know, when I blast somebody, actually, there's somebody there and they really got hurt, you know. And I want to have enough presence of mind not to do that. That's like sort of step A. A lot of parents, when I work with parents, it's such a powerful thing to have a child. I don't know how many of you are parents, but to have a child and to see that if you lose it, they get really hurt. These little people get really hurt. That we want, you know, some of their motivation in the beginning was just really not wanting to be hurtful with their children. And that motivated people to practice mindfulness practice and loving kindness practice in order to minimize the harming. But as people practice, and with the parent group that I have now, it's really remarkable to see parents come in frustrated. Now I'm kind of on the end of making, as well as my own practice, making a space for other people to practice. People come in with the frustration and the anger and the credit report and the, you know, the this and that and what's happening, you know, the loans and like we're, a lot of us are dealing with right now, and the frustration, and to watch them kind of walk in with their child and attention, and then to see people practice for a day and to see what happens, you know, this kind of blooming in the parents and in the children of these qualities of mind that we could create this space, as we're doing in this center and centers all over, where we actually have access to these qualities that are innate in our mind. As every bit as much as we've got the greed, hatred, and delusion, we've also got the compassion and the loving kindness and the equanimity and the joy that we can cultivate, but also more fundamentally, they're there in the nature of our mind. And this was part of what Buddhas discover. There's something in the canon. There's a part with the Buddha talking about imbuing the mind or experiencing the mind as one quarter loving kindness, one quarter compassion, one quarter equanimity, and one quarter joy. When I first heard that, I thought, well, is it like this corner or is it like this corner? I was kind of trying to, this was my mind when I started practicing. So, and more like, you know, like there's this radiance, right? These qualities, they kind of balance each other in our mind. So there's this beauty in watching parents kind of come to that and watching relationships between parents and children change, and even the little children. I have a lot of the children I work with are 4 and 5. That's the main kind of age group that I work with the most of the time. So one of the little boys, we do something with the children where we have a meditation with a bell. And one time we were doing this practice, there's a Tibetan version, and then it also, I found out it's also in the canon as well, where one meditates one's mind. In the Tibetan version, it's from Milarepa, and they talk about meditating your mind like the ocean. Well, actually, historically, the Buddha talked about the kasina of water, you know, the element of water. So one meditates one's mind as the water. So I was doing this with the children, and they were meditating. They're very still. They sit in their, what they call their lotus, which some of them is a 2-foot lotus, some is a 1-foot lotus, some is a no foot lotus. That's how we talk about it. Anyway, they were sitting there meditating their mind like the water. And so after the meditation, I said to them, "So what's in your mind?" And they said, "Fish." Of course. So I said, "Great." So I said, "What are the fish like? How do they feel?" Somebody said, "There's an angry fish." Somebody said, "There's a sad fish." Somebody said, "There's a yearning fish. Didn't I want mommy?" So we began to play with these fish. We gave them a color. So I said, "What color is your angry fish?" "Red," or whatever it was, right? So then we'd all get up and we'd swim around and we'd be the angry fish. And then we'd ring a bell. We'd ring the bowl bell like this. And they all sat down. And then we'd see if we could let the fish swim through. And somebody else said, I have a joyful fish. So we'd all swim around, leaping. We'd follow them, whatever they were doing. Joyful fish. And then we'd ring the bell, and we'd all sit down. We'd see what the joy fish went through. So after doing this for a few weeks, one little boy in the middle of the playtime, our shrine room, we have a room, meditation room, that's separate from the main playroom. So we're in the playroom. He had this really frustrating thing between two children. They had, you know, trees, and like they were trying to make a little puppet show story. And we had one little three-year-old who was grabbing this five-year-old's kind of stuff and knocking it down a lot. And he was really trying, I saw him, he was really trying to be patient, but he just got so frustrated and he was really angry. So he decided to run into the shrine room. Now, I don't tell the children they should run into the shrine room to work with their anger, but he did. He sat down in the shrine room. He said, what are you doing in the shrine room, Nathaniel? He said, my anger fish is swimming. And I said, oh, okay. So he sat, and so I sat with him. And he said, the anger fish wants to drink up all the water. Isn't that what it's like? The anger fish wants to drink up all our clarity of mind. There's that feeling. He said, it's drinking up all the water. And I said, but you're so big. The water's so big. And he said, yeah. So he sat there for a while, mad. And then he said, and I'm sad fish. Okay. And then he said, yeah, now I know what I want to say to him. So he went back with this clarity to the little boy and said, look, you can have these trees. I'm going to have these trees. This is what I'm making a puppet show. I'm making a story here. You can help me. This is beautiful kind of clarity from this five-year-old. So same boy, like the next week, we were practicing, he said, I'll let all the fish come except the anger fish. And I said, well, how come, Nathaniel? Why? He said, because the anger fish can hurt people if you don't know you're the water. And I said, yeah, but we're learning that, so it's all right. We can let it come. So the children can feel this quite easily in themselves, and we can feel this in ourselves. And we're learning to be the water in some sense. We're learning to know that we are the water, as well as that these kind of energies come through us. One of the things I learned, you know, early in my practice, an example that was really helpful for me, is if we could think of these qualities of anger or grasping or confusion as like weather, like forces that come through our mind rather than who we are. I don't even say to the children, you're angry, to mirror them, because I think it's not actually true. We aren't the anger. The anger comes through us and we experience that and we need to acknowledge it, but to say that's what we are, to tell a child that's what they are, I don't use that language for it. So, anyway, as we come to work with these qualities in ourselves and get more comfortable with them, that this is just part of who we are, and insights start to come around how those all work in our minds, and we start to encounter these other qualities in ourselves more frequently, there can become a sense of this actually being like the background or the kind of what we know when we relax. That there's this loving kindness has a spaciousness quality to it in our mind, an embracing quality. That compassion wants to act to benefit others. That it just wants that all by itself, kind of. One little girl told me at the table one day, we were sitting, we do our meals in kind of a warm, I call a warm, twinkly quiet. It's not a still, stiff quiet. We twinkle each other, but we light a candle, we say a blessing, we're quiet. So one little girl's turn was like, we were serving something really yummy, I can't remember what it was, maybe watermelon, and her turn was last, just that was the order of things. They serve each other usually, but anyway, she was last. And she said, my patience fish is here. I said, beautiful, let's let that swim around for a while. So these qualities of the paramis are also there in us. And there are some teachings from the Tibetan tradition that I also wanted to share too. Actually, Guy gave me this book too, called the Lojong Teachings, if anybody's interested. These teachings sort of take it even a bit further, I think. Those qualities are there, and these difficult states of mind arise. But there's a possibility that's very inspiring to me that's expressed in these teachings of actually embracing, really embracing the adversity as a path. I had an experience about 8 years ago where I was in a spiritual community with actually a wonderful teacher and great people in many ways. But I got into an interpersonal tangle with the teacher, very difficult for me and I think for the teacher as well, and felt, you know, ended up initially seeing it as a situation where I felt really judged and, oh, you know, hurt, and seeing myself as a victim. And ultimately, these teachings really helped me to see that the experience of being judged or feeling maligned by someone or whatever, that there was this possibility of really seeing that as a gift. Really seeing that as a gift to help develop the patience and stability in my mind. So these are a whole series of teachings that have to do with the cultivation and development of the bodhicitta, the aspiration to awaken to benefit beings, and its qualities. So I'm going to, this is a kind of a famous quote, and I'm just going to read it here. To cover the earth with sheets of leather, where could such amounts of skin be found? But simply wrap some leather around your feet, and it's as if the whole world has been covered. So this way that in being able to look at ourselves, we start to see that it's ourselves that can go through this transformation, and that that's what, and that, I mean, for myself as an anger type, I had a lot of like trying to change everything else. Of course, we need to act, and at times we need to speak strongly, but that actually it's ourselves that has the possibility of transforming and transforming our lives in that way. Let's see if there are other ones from here. So, bodhicitta. Actually, two aspects of bodhicitta are discussed in these teachings, and they're described like the two wings of a bird, that the bird can't fly straight without wisdom and compassion. And that the compassion wing is the relative bodhicitta. It's the expression that the heart has in itself of wanting to do benefit for others. And that the more absolute bodhicitta is really the recognition of the empty, open nature of our being. That in some way, all of these things, the difficult emotions that we have and others have, and the unskillful motivations, and these more positive qualities, are in some sense, they're empty of a self. They're empty of someone who has them. That in some sense, these things come and they go. Our bodies come and go. Our feelings and thoughts come and go. And that there's something actually really freeing about that recognition that doesn't hold these things so tightly as mine, but yet can see the suffering of ourselves and of sentient beings and want to respond out of our nature. That the insight that rides right in the middle there is the bird that's flying in this path that we're on. So can we just sit? I'd like to just sit for a minute. So I'd like to suggest a little reflection inwardly to just look at your relationship to practice and what brings you to that right now in yourself. Just to kind of reflect, no judgment about it, but just in this time, what brings you? What calls you? How did you get here, or how do you keep coming? Are there things that you discover in yourself that are compelling through this practice that bring you back to want to understand more or experience more? What has opened in you through practice that feels beneficial? Remember to let yourself notice that. For some people, it can be hard to see the positive qualities in themselves, to let themselves be aware of that. But see if you can really open yourself to notice if there are things that have opened or have changed in your experience through practice. And then if you'd open your eyes, and if it feels right to you, no pressure to do this, and if you sit with your eyes closed, people are knowing you're not going to do this right now, but to turn to somebody near you and share with them two things. One is anything that has opened in practice that feels like it's beneficial for you. And the second, how does that affect your motivation in practice, or what motivates you or draws you to practice at this time in your life? So if people want to spend just like a couple minutes each way, and I'll ring a bell after maybe 2 or 3 minutes and we can switch if people want to do that. I like to nourish the community part of Sangha, and to me this is part of being Sangha for each other. So I'll say the two questions again. One is, what has opened in you that feels beneficial? Don't be shy. It's great for other people to hear positive things. It helps inspire other people. And secondly, what motivates you or draws you into practice in this time in your life, or keeps you returning? So if you haven't yet switched to the second person, you could be switching. So as you find your way through your last few sentences, not to be abruptly cutting off here, but if we could come back together. So first, I'd like everybody to just sit for a minute and see what that was like to talk to each other. This is like Sangha, right? How does it feel to be received and to share about yourself in that way? And let's just take a minute here to feel that. And is there anything anybody wants to say about that in the group, about what that was like or how it is to be seen? And if there's not, that's fine. I think it's very important to be Sangha for one another and to really be able to receive each other's development. Sangha being one of the three jewels, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, we can't do it without each other. So being able to receive each other in our motivations as that develops and in our developments of qualities is really a way of supporting, bringing that forth in each other and for each other. So that's kind of the end of what I had to say this evening. I wondered if anybody has any questions for me. I do this program with parents and children. If you want to ask anything about that, or I'd love to know if there's some of you that are parents and how old your children are and if you've experimented with practicing with them at all. One of the things that happens out of our program is the parents and children end up wanting to practice together a lot. some of the parents, actually about half of our parents in our group currently, didn't practice before this program that we have. They had just heard of it because I was a children's teacher. And so they now, a lot of them have a daily practice at home. And their children have inspired that. Children have wanted to make a place to sit and to practice. So I'd like to know, could you raise your hand to know if some of your parents, there's a few of you, yeah. And have you practiced with your children, or how has there been anybody willing to say a little bit? Yeah.
My daughter is, 12? My son's a sophomore in high school, and my daughter's a bit responsive. She's, when I come home and just talk about things, my son just rolls his eyes. I mean, he's the scientist. It's all computers with him. He's figuring out the world, the way the world works mechanically.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, computers are fairly predictable compared to people. So, you know, the people are just strange things out there. And I'm just not going to push anything. I just realize when the time comes, he'll know which books to go start reading on the shelf and, you know, where to turn to maybe learn a little bit more about things outside there.
Great, thanks. Yeah, well, interestingly, in the science part, there's quite a bit of research. I actually was at a workshop with Daniel Siegel a month or so ago, and he was talking about there being over 600 studies on mindfulness now and what happens in brain development in relation to mindfulness, that there's actually an area of the prefrontal cortex that thickens with a lot of mindfulness practice. And this area in the prefrontal cortex, kind of back in that area of the brain, there's an area there, that the area that thickens, that is associated with compassion, with attunement to others, with executive function, increased executive function, and a number of other qualities. It has a lot of ramifications for education, so I'm not saying you need to go home and tell your son this necessarily, but it is interesting, and there are some people who come in the science angle, including actually some of the kids, older kids are kind of interested in my brain changes. It's kind of a cool thing to think about. I have a 13-year-old goddaughter who I've helped raise, and she's interested in the science part of it. Anybody else want to say anything about your children? Yes.
So I have a 2.5-year-old, and I can say I've got such clinging to when you talk about your program, because I'm like, how come she can't be down here? I think last night I was looking up some, you know, preschools and just looking up mindfulness preschool, because, you know, I'm on this trek, and I'm like, how cool would it be to raise a daughter? But lo and behold, I think San Jose was like, there's one place there, and then I found your name, and I'm like, oh, it's too far. I keep getting excited, but I find myself, you know, going, oh, just when she turns 4 or 5, that'll be the time. But now I'm like, how do I practice with her? I don't try to force, like, the meditation part, like, let's sit still, because she's too much of a, I want to move around, I don't want to sit still to listen to a whole story. But it's funny, because when she's eating, and sometimes I'm upset because she's eating slowly, but too slowly for me, I'll start doing my breathing, and she'll be like, Mimi meditation, or, you know, she won't pronounce it right, but she's picking up some of the things that I do, and it's pretty adorable, and I think I'm just really excited to see what happens. But I've got a question for you,
yes.
That, you know, when they're that young, because my understanding from talking to different teachers is, they start introducing certain things when they're a little older, mm-hmm. like, you know, in about maybe 3, 4, you know, 4 or 5. So at this age, is there anything
can
do?
Yeah, I think there are a lot of things you can actually do. And it's true, yeah, you don't want to insist on stillness in a way that's going to feel oppressive to them. But you can tell stories. You can even just tell stories about yourself when you were little that have a little bit of a theme of compassion or loving kindness. You can tell stories. You can sit. What I used to do with my goddaughter when she was that little, we had a shrine, but with her I would use it to tell stories. And she liked to come sometimes to sit because I was sitting. But, you know, she could bring her stuffed animal or something and put it on her lap and, you know, would sit. And her attention for that was minimal. But both our sitting practice and just seeing our own mindfulness, there's actually starting to be some research about this too. Daniel Siegel, who wrote the book The Mindful Brain, and I think the other one's called The Developing Mind. He talks about one of the things, the indications, the research is indicating that not only practicing mindfulness oneself benefits oneself, but that parents or teachers practicing mindfulness, that the children's, we all have a mirror neuron system, we all have a nervous system that kind of mirrors others, that because that's really strong in children in early childhood, that they actually will be mirroring that and their nervous system will develop differently if they're around parents and teachers that are practicing. Now, this is really wonderful. So your own practice of mindfulness in daily life, like you're saying, the eating and being doing your meditation when you're eating or when you're washing dishes or when you're attending to the child, if you're really doing mindfulness practice inwardly, you can actually be helping the child develop those qualities vicariously. Now, my other, you know, I have part of me in Dharma and part of what I do is from Waldorf Education. Interestingly, Rudolf Steiner, who's the founder of Waldorf Education, also said this. He said that when he trained teachers in the classroom to work with early childhood, he said if you mindfully and with a kind of a relaxed, focused attention, I think is the way he talked about it, do the tasks of daily living and really kind of in an open, spacious way. So it's not just kind of like, you know, okay, we're cleaning the house, but what we would consider mindfulness practice, doing the cleaning or whatever, that this was really good for young children, that it helped develop their focus and their concentration. Well, now there's neural research. There wasn't in his day, but that supports this. Now we have, you know, we kind of understand what's happening in the brain and why that happens. But you can benefit your child a lot through your own practice. I also think it's really nice to have a place where you practice, where you do formal sitting practice, and maybe you have a Buddha image or you have a flowers or you have something there. People have different relationship to whether they want to have a statue there or not. But for children, it's really nice to have a place. And they could bring flowers there. They can bring, you know, it can be kind of a celebratory place with you. Some parents I've known that have really little ones, the child could sit on their lap and just kind of feel, okay, this is breathing, this is presence, you know, for as long as they can do that. Then some parents who really wanted to practice and have little one, as they get a little bit older, and having sitting time was tricky, you know, in the family, would have a special basket of arts materials that were self-service that they would bring down while the parent would practice, and that's the only time those special things would come. You know, maybe there's glue sticks and, you know, little treasures or something to glue. And then one woman I knew, her teacher had actually given her the instruction to practice 2 hours a day, and she had an extremely active three and a half, four-year-old when I first knew her, she was 3 and a half. And she said to me, how in the world can I do this? Because I'm a single mom. She's actually a single mom. And I said, well, maybe you could start with, like, you know, 3 or 4 minutes that you bring this basket down and he has a table and he sits and he does that. And then you meditate and then he comes. There's like a ritual. The bell rings and then you go and look at what he's made. So she actually developed with him over time, so that ultimately she was able to do an hour practice and an hour at night as a single mom with her child happily busy with what he was making, knowing that he was going to get this great, super present attention from her at the end of it when the bell rang. And then ultimately the child got interested in practicing later. So I think there's a lot of things that you can do to nourish that. And in terms of there only being a few programs, yeah, there are, but there's a lot of interest. Guy Armstrong has been referring some different teachers to me who are interested in learning, and I think, you know, there's a center in L.A. that's doing research, and there's a woman that has a Susan, I've forgotten her last name, but the website is Inner Kids. There's a site, you might check that out on the web, and there's going to be more training of teachers. I'm interested in helping teachers learn that could then help feed programs different places. So, anyway, good luck to you. Anybody else about your children? Yes. I can hear you.
Okay. Now it's on. First of all, I like to hear the sound of my own voice, so I always participate, or participate. I don't know why, but I do. So I have an older daughter, and I got her when she was, I got custody when she was 14. And I had been working on the spiritual path for a long time, in and out of it, and doing different things. And I started to utilize Tibetan chakra center sounds with an eclectic other spiritual sounds of horns and the drum beating, and then also a drum beat, the heartbeat on each chakra center going all the way up. And it had all these different, and it had Tibetan monks, real deep. And my daughter would come in, and she'd just be like, wow. It would just be like, whoa, you know, she'd go from this, like, state of, like, just like, whacked out. You know how teenagers are. They're in and out and all about, right? And she'd just, like, come to this state of, like, calmness.
Yeah.
Because of the delta wave that was there, you know, while I was meditating. Even though she wasn't meditating, she was in the center of what I had made feng shui, you know, with statues and flowers and different things to kind of bring the energy in. And then my brother, who's really just like, doesn't like that kind of stuff at all, he was like put to sleep by it. And then after a while, he would ask me, are you going to meditate? And he wanted to hear it, right? And it was like it helped him get of peace, even though he was just very angry.
Yeah.
And so I found that just by the aesthetics, like the statues, the flowers and sounds and smells and openness and all that kind of feng shui energy where the energy, qi energy was moving, actually did in fact affect someone who was not even being interested at
yes.
all in it.
Yes, and I think it's really powerful in terms of this aspiration to be of benefit, if that makes sense. You know, Guy Armstrong told me that, he actually told a group of people on a retreat that I was attending recently, that of the people practicing in this tradition in the West that he knew, really practicing fairly seriously, all of the Westerners that he knew embraced this aspiration to awaken to benefit beings as path. That he actually didn't know anybody for whom that really didn't make any sense, that it really was something that made sense to a lot of people. And I think, you know, it can be very inspiring to recognize that we can be sitting in an airport and practicing and it can affect beneficially people around us. We can be teaching in a classroom. We can be working in a store. We can be wherever we are. Our practice can benefit people around us, our children, our spouses. We really, and so, anyway, I love what you're saying because I think, you know, there is this way that in our culture, sometimes it can be hard to really value practice if we kind of see it as not doing all these other things we're supposed to be doing, to value it enough that we really make the time to practice. But it can help to realize that, in fact, yes, we are practicing for those around us as well as ourselves. I mean, it really does have that impact, and now we even know it affects people's neurology. You know, that vibration actually affects people's bodies, especially kids, because they're very open. Yeah, anybody else want anything to share? Yes. We're going just a couple minutes over. I want to acknowledge that. Can we take just a few minutes to wrap? Yeah. Okay.
Well, I have three kids, and they're not at all enthusiastic about this Buddhism thing. And they see it as a religion, and they've been raised not really to be religious. And I just try to explain that it's a practice of self-improvement, not really a religion. And, you know, I see the benefits. My 18-year-old, who's still at home, she's calmer than she used to be. And actually, this is my oldest son here beside me tonight, and he's come here for the first time, and his girlfriend sitting here on the floor. So this is really a nice thing for us to be here tonight, and I really enjoyed your talk about kids.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you. One of the things, I just wanted to say one more little thing about mindfulness practice. It's being brought into schools now, just touching on your theme about religion versus not religion. My program, we happen to be doing it in a Dharma context, but it's now being done as mindfulness practice in public schools in various places, just as mindfulness practice, and very powerful that way. And one research study I just wanted to mention, this is very interesting in terms of older children and learning. They had students practice 20 minutes of mindfulness, just mindfulness practice, before they listened to an informational, a talk, you know, a lecture. And then they had a control group. And this was a fairly broad study, actually. I think they did quite a few people and they averaged this. And then they had a control group and then they tested them on the results of their, how much they had learned from the lecture, how much the information they retained. And the group that did mindfulness averaged 40% more retention of the information after 20 minutes of mindfulness practice. They had had a class first to learn mindfulness practice, but then practicing it for 20 minutes before the lecture, they retained 40% more information. So this is kind of astounding academically. So I just feel like this, and yes, our children are going to sometimes not want it. My 13-year-old who now practices went through a period of years where she wasn't interested and then became interested again after practicing when she was little. So sometimes that happens and sometimes not. But at any rate, being around our practice is very, very helpful. So anyway, I'm really thrilled for all your practice. I love sitting with you. It felt very good in here. I can feel the strength of people's practice and aspiration. And I'll stay around because we really should close now since we're a little bit over. And if anybody else has anything else to ask or to say, I'd love to talk to you. And again, the website is www.mindfulness-education.org if anybody wants to connect with me or our program that way. Thank you.